Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. David Caron, who is going to discuss harmful algal blooms in the ocean. Dave grew up in southeast Massachusetts. He got interested in marine science, like many oceanographers did, by watching Jacques Cousteau. He is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Southern California, where he's been now for the past 16 years. He has a bachelor's degree in microbiology and a master's degree in oceanography, both from the University of Rhode Island, and a PhD in biological oceanography from the joint program of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Did a postdoc after getting his PhD at Columbia, then went back to Woods Hole for more than a decade before deciding to move to better climate, better weather out here in California. His research interests involve the ecology of microbes in marine and freshwater ecosystems. He has ongoing research programs involving studies of harmful algae and cyanobacteria, and has studied the biodiversity of microbes in locations ranging from the Antarctic to deep sea hydrothermal events. A remarkable researcher, he has written, authored, or co-authored more than 200 scientific articles in the peer-reviewed refereed literature and book chapters. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Microbiology, and several other national professional societies. Please join me in welcoming Dave Caron to the aquarium.
Well, it's true. I was inspired by Jacques Cousteau, but don't worry, I won't speak in an outrageous French accent. But I changed my interests quite some time ago to little things in the ocean. And I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about some of those little things, some of the not so nice little things. But before I talk about the dark side of algae, I want to mention or make a plug that of course, most algae are good, and they are our friends, as I've indicated down here. This is a pattern that is very familiar to biological oceanographers. It's sort of a generalized pattern of primary production, the production of organic material by photosynthetic organisms in the world ocean. And I put a few statistics down here just to remind you that, in fact, algae are our friends. About 95% of all the living biomass in the oceans is microbial. We don't often think of that, but that is the case. In fact, I just read a paper that has come out within the last few weeks. I read it within the last few weeks, and it indicates that there may be as many as 1 trillion species on the globe. And of course, most of that is microbiological, that it's a little hard to tell sometimes what constitutes a species. People argue about that. But nonetheless, most of what's there, most of the species, most of the biomass are little things. And photosynthetic microbes play key roles in ecosystems. They support most, if not almost all, of the major fisheries in the ocean. They produce about half of the global oxygen that we use every day as oxygen-demanding organisms. And they also do us a favor in that they draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere into the ocean, put it into organic material and skeletons. And then if that material sinks into the deep ocean, they effectively have removed it from the atmosphere and all of its implications for climate change and carbon in the atmosphere on the order of thousands of years. So they really do quite a bit. But let's back up a little bit and talk a little bit about what actually is in a drop of water. A lot of people have a feeling for this, so a lot of people don't. In the background, you're going to see a globe appear, and again, one of these sort of models of primary production on the face of the Earth. But if we look at what is in a teaspoon of water, we're talking about 5 milliliters of water. And some of you may know, if you have scientific backgrounds, but many of you may not know and may be a little shocked to find out that there are about 50 million viruses, about 5 million bacteria, about 10,000 microalgae, and about 5,000 protozoa in your basic teaspoon of water. So if you go into a freshwater or a marine environment, you duck your head underwater and you come up with a little bit of liquid, that's what you're getting. Fortunately, most of those are completely harmless and actually beneficial. A few of them are not. And we're going to talk about those today. And really what we have here are a couple of groups. The algae here that I've already mentioned, and that comes in the title of this talk. And then also some bacteria are cyanobacteria, and they are photosynthetic organisms, although they don't have the same cellular organization as microalgae. But that's really the focus. Most of these are good guys. And there'll be a quiz later. You can tell me what's wrong with this picture. Okay. So most of these are good most of the time. A few of them are not. And in fact, this is sort of the dark side of algae and cyanobacteria. About 2 years ago now, just a little less than 2 years ago, Toledo found out kind of full force what the problem you can face with some of these organisms is. And here what we're looking at is some of the headings, the newspaper clippings and so forth, from a large bloom of cyanobacteria that were on the western, bloomed in the western edge of Lake Erie. And right down here is Toledo. They draw their water from this area. And the shore waters looked like that. This green is from a cyanobacterium called Microcystis, and it produces a suite of toxins called microcystins. If you haven't heard of them, you will. This shut down Toledo's water supply for about 2.5 days. So hundreds of thousands of people without drinkable water for 2.5 days. Well, you just boil it, right? Nope, can't boil it. Microcystins will stand up to some degree of boiling, and so they were without water, and they trucked in a lot of water. Oops. And there's our little dark side coming out. Okay. So now this is something that is not simply our problem. It's not simply Toledo's problem. It is, as I've indicated up here, a global problem. It's global in nature. Just as another example, this is real imagery. It's true color imagery of Lake Taihu, and that is near Shanghai, near the coast of China. And what you're looking at are, and this has been enhanced with color here, this again is a satellite image, and this is the enhancement showing the formation of a bloom, another cyanobacterial bloom, also Microcystis. These kinds of problems are appearing more and more. Now, usually for these kinds of things, we talk about harmful algal blooms, and that's in the title. We usually abbreviate this HABs, H-A-Bs, if you will. An older terminology that people used to use is something called red tides, and I'm sure some of you have heard the term red tide before, particularly on our coast, and you'll see some. You'll see some pictures of it. This is actually not our coast. This is the west coast of Florida, and this dark kind of reddish-brownish mass, if you can make it out, you can see unaffected water up here, that is a true red tide, very nasty. The organism that produces that produces a neurotoxin. And when the organisms in the water are brought into shore, into breaking waves, the cells are broken open by the action of the breaking waves, that neurotoxin is aerosolized, and anyone on the beach will be inhaling that, and it can be a real problem for people who are compromised in terms of their lung function. However, most of the things that we see in the ocean and in freshwater are not necessarily red. So we've moved away from this misnomer of red tides, and we typically call these things as HABs or harmful algal blooms. The term actually includes cyanobacteria, which, as I said, technically aren't algae, but still sort of function that way. Okay, so just to give this sort of a local flavor, and I am going to talk about some of the local issues, kind of going from not so bad to worse as we go through the talk. But just to give you an idea, Toledo and Taihu and those places, they're not the only places that face these issues. This is a local issue as well. This is Pinto Lake, which is up in Central California, and you can see the color there. Just to go back for a second, please don't ever do this at home. That is not the way to sample a toxic algal bloom, even though that is a world-known algal bloom specialist. You should know better. This is the way you do it. You can use the glove of your color choice, but purple seems to work really well. But in any event, you can see the massive blooms that are built up in this particular lake. This is something that is going on throughout the world. Now, I won't go into the details of this, but there are a variety of compounds. There are well over 100 compounds now that have been identified, produced by cyanobacteria or various types of algae that have various toxic characteristics. In addition, there are a number that don't necessarily produce toxins, but are still noxious or unpalatable. But the really nasty ones are these neurotoxins and hepatotoxins, and you'll see some of this as we go on. There are also organisms which produce substances that are cell cycle disruptors. What that means is it stops your cells from dividing or reproducing properly. And as you might guess, these substances are often tumor promoters. In addition, there are skin irritants. There are sometimes multiple toxins present simultaneously. And there are certainly other yet undescribed toxins that we just don't know about yet. So there are a whole suite of these things that do appear. How do we get into trouble with these, or how do ecosystems get into trouble? This is through food web connections. So here in the center, we have a couple of groups of real culprits. Shellfish, which bivalve shellfish in particular, they're filter feeding organisms. They filter the algae out of the water. They concentrate it in their stomach. You eat that clam or mussel or whatever, and you get the toxin that's present in its stomach. And also planktivorous fish. This is a particular problem on our coast where anchovies and sardines use these little gill rakers, which you can see out in the aquarium, to filter plankton out of the water. If that plankton is toxic, their bellies are toxic. And if something comes along and eats them, then that becomes toxic. So there are no surprises there how these things become available to us. What that means is you can go virtually anywhere in the world where there's an aquatic ecosystem where somebody is watching it and knowing what's going on, and you may find one of these very nasty signs which tells you not to eat the shellfish or not to do something. This one up here, if you can read it, basically it tells you to do everything, not to do anything near the water, period. In it, near it, around it. So there are some very nasty problems out there. Okay, so let's back up again for a second. Why in the world would algae produce toxins? It's not really clear that they're trying to kill us, unless you believe in really bad science fiction movies. It's not clear and it's not likely that they're trying to kill sea lions or pelicans or anything else that is affected. But in fact, pure and simple, the bottom line is it's chemical warfare. These organisms have developed defenses to keep themselves from being eaten or to protect themselves from competitors that they're trying to grow in the presence of. So like this little diagram here or animation with Calvin in it shows, just as Calvin hates to eat his vegetables, grazer deterrence is really one of the reasons why we think many of these toxins are produced. These organisms are producing substances that make them taste bad to the things that want to eat them. Unfortunately for them and unfortunately for us, things like planktivorous fish and clams and mussels don't seem to mind the toxins too much, but we certainly do. But they're probably deterring predators that are on their same size range, so microscopic predators. That's certainly one of the things. Another couple of hypotheses that have been suggested is that these compounds are allelopathic. And what that means is the idea is you will try to kill or inhibit the growth of your competing species. And by doing that, you hold their growth back and all of the resources are present for you to use. So if they're competing with other phytoplankton and those phytoplankton aren't growing, the organism that is producing the toxin has the ability to gather all the nutrients that are out there for its growth. So accessing major nutrients and other elements that it requires. Another idea that's certainly been hypothesized is either metal acquisition or metal sequestration. We do know that we need metals. For example, iron is a very important element that is present in vanishingly small amounts in many parts of the ocean. And it has been suggested that these toxic compounds are actually toxic maybe by chance, but what they really do is they go out into the environment, they bind up iron, and they deliver it back to the algal cell so no one else can get it. We know that bacteria do this. It's been suggested that some of these toxins play the same role for algae. Or they're doing the flip side. In an environment where there's too much of a metal that they don't want to be exposed to, and the example I use here is copper. If copper is present at high concentration, it will kill algae. So maybe they're sending that material out there, the toxin out, binding the copper and keeping it from being bioavailable to the alga and thereby benefiting themselves. So these are kind of the probable reasons. HAB toxins are a real problem. They are problematic for a couple of reasons. For one thing that they are and a few things that they are not. What they are is harmful at minute amounts, at picogram quantities. And if you can't see that, that's a bunch of zeros. It's 14 zeros with a 2 at the end of it. That's how many grams of material that is present in a picogram and the concentration at which these things are toxic. So they are incredibly toxic. In fact, one group of algal toxins is registered along with ricin as something that needs to be watched from a chemical weapons point of view. So they are quite toxic and at low concentrations, and therefore detection can be very challenging for these organisms. A couple of things they might not be, and that's detected without sophisticated approaches. If you're trying to get things at picogram quantities, really quantitatively, it's very, very difficult. And most of these compounds at even reasonable concentrations have no taste, no smell, so you're not going to know they're present. And as I mentioned before, some of them can't be eliminated or destroyed easily. Some are heat and acid stable. So you can boil your water, but it's not going to necessarily kill the microcystins that are in there. And that it has real implications as well for trying to follow some of these substances. Well, I've kind of suggested that we're seeing an increase in the incidence of these things. We, in fact, are. Just some of the proof for that is shown here. What you're looking at are two figures or two images of the world, drawings here. 1970, the little red dots that you can see in various places are where we knew paralytic shellfish poisoning toxin produced by an alga was present in the water in 1970. Now in 2014, you can see where all of these red dots are over here. Now that definitely is a difference. But what are we talking about? Are we talking about increased distribution? Are we talking about things just getting around and then showing up in various places? Are we talking about increased occurrence? That is, they're there, but they bloom better. Or are we talking about increased awareness? And these last two, I think a really good analogy is if you know what Lyme disease is. Lyme disease was discovered for the first time or described from Lyme, Connecticut. That's why it's called Lyme disease. And in fact, it was something we really didn't know what to look for the symptoms. It causes various types of arthritic conditions, neurological conditions. It's transmitted by the bite of a tick, which carries a spirochete, which gives you the disease. Once they knew what to look for, Lyme disease showed up all over the country. So in fact, it was there. It was increased awareness that allowed us to see it. On the other hand, if you think of West Nile, you know, you kind of had a week, if not monthly, kind of prognosis of where West Nile was going to be as it marched across the country, carried mostly, I guess, by the bird populations. That is true emerging disease. We're dealing with some of that in with these organisms. So the other part of this then, too, the increased distribution. We do know that, especially in the past, ballast water, before they had ways of treating it and dealing with it, carried a lot of these organisms around. They're microscopic. It's really easy to get them moving around. So the answer to this question, which are we dealing with, is yes. It's really all three of them. However, some of them have been around a long time. And I don't want to get biblical on you, but this is biblical. And in fact, if you look down at the bottom, this is about the great plagues of Egypt. And down here, one of these plagues, of course, was the Nile turning to blood. If you are a HAB researcher, sometimes you might want to take this as the first written documented proof that a red tide occurred and somebody documented it. I'm not saying that that's what this is, but in fact, it's been suggested that this may actually have indicated that there was a red tide at this time around the Nile. Interestingly, this organism, the genus name for this is Alexandrium. This is an electron micrograph of eight organisms kind of in tandem there. And this is one of the major, this genus is one of the major producers of paralytic shellfish poisoning, which is one of our nastiest red tides. And I've always thought that this was named for somebody named Alexander. It kind of was. But actually, I met the taxonomist several years ago, who's probably 100 years old, has been doing this all his life. He described this genus, and he described it from samples that he took from Alexandria, which is named for Alexander the Great. So indirectly, it was named for a person, but it's really named for Alexandria. So coincidence, right near the mouth of the Nile, who knows? Okay. So moving back now to more local issues. Again, I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what we've seen on our coast, what are present, kind of going from not so bad to really quite bad. Locally, in our marine waters, in our region, our occurrences of red tides, new things. If you ask most people, they'd probably go, yeah, I just heard about those in the last couple of years. Well, this is a report from 1902 from Torrey, and what he describes here is a very, quote-unquote, unusual bloom of an organism which we actually still see to this day here. But this is well over 100 years ago. And this organism was already present in San Pedro waters, so just across the bay. This particular organism, they said, the report says, they saw in the 80s. And that's not the 1980s. This is 1902. This is the 1880s. They were already seeing these things. Fishermen were reporting these. So a lot of these organisms, we feel, have been around for some period of time, and it's maybe that they're just, there's some environmental change that's taking place which is stimulating them to occur more frequently. And that, of course, is a big part of our research. Also local, if you go on the web and you type in Google on red tides, California, you'll see this picture, I guarantee you. It's by Peter Franks down at Scripps. It's been on the web for quite a while. It is a very distinct accumulation of an organism called one type of dinoflagellate. It's this organism with the name of Noctiluca scintillans. And it produces this large, very colorful, but really pretty innocuous blooms. A red tide, but not really a toxic organism. One of the reasons why we prefer to use HAB rather than red tide. If you Google Noctiluca and you Google Australia, you will come up with pictures like this, which are real color. These have not been touched or touched up. And you can see this guy who clearly has not read or seen any good science fiction movies lately or horror movies, about 6 feet from one of these massive blooms. The color of these is just astounding. And here, this one just kills me. I hope that she knew before she took her toddler and her unborn child to the beach that this was a non-toxic bloom that was taking place. You don't always know. But in any event, very colorful and interesting place, Australia. If we get more local, a different organism, but also causing relatively benign red tides. Don't know if you can see the color right along the coast here. This is La Jolla. It's a Scripps Pier right there. It's caused by this organism, if you were to look at that water through the microscope. This is unconcentrated water in a bucket and unconcentrated water in a 4-liter or 4-gallon container. So extremely dense concentrations of an organism, also a dinoflagellate called Lingulodinium polyhedrum. The organism is not toxic, and again, Australia comes into play, go figure. These are pictures of luminescence here right at the coast, breaking waves, and then somebody throwing some sort of objects into the water to create a splash. Many of these organisms create spectacular bioluminescence, and if you've been lucky enough to be on the beaches here at night, you may have run into this in late summer and fall. Not to worry, this particular organism, as I say, is really not so bad. So we've gone through a couple of these fairly innocuous red tides, so you'll know enough now not to listen to that term so much. HAB is the term you want to listen for, harmful algal bloom. We're going to move down a little bit then to ones that actually have a little bit more punch to them in terms of ecosystem impacts. And these are organisms that cause noxious foams and scums. And just as an example of that, these are some pictures that were sent to me of what we call green scums, lovingly. Most people, you know, get a phone call saying, Dave, I've got, you know, tickets to the Warriors playoff game. And it's like, no. I get calls that say, Dave, I've got pictures of green scum. Do you want them? And of course we do. You know, what can I say? We go out and get some. And it turns out to be a very little tiny alga, this little thing right here called Tetraselmus. It's only a few micrometers in size. It's not much bigger than a bacterium. But it forms these huge accumulations right at the air-water interface. And what we think is going on is that the organism is photoprotected. It has natural sunscreens in it. But the organisms that consume it probably don't. And so they're excluded from those very surface waters. So this guy is forming these little noxious blooms, disrupting food web function by not allowing that energy to pass up to larger organisms, and in the process, of course, doing a good thing for itself. Other organisms that we see don't necessarily form scums, but they form more of these foam-like structures. It's kind of a meringue. And the organism, the causative organism here, is something in a group of algae in the genus Phaeacystis. And if you can make out, there is sort of a balloon-like structure here with little tiny green dots in it. Again, the alga is just microscopic, very tiny in size. But in this case, it forms a large sort of a balloon made out of mucus material. And the algae are stuck in the very surface of the balloon, the very skin of the balloon. Occasionally, when these things get whipped up into surface waters, or if the cells abandon the mucus, that mucus material can get worked up by the waves, and it can turn into kind of a foam. This organism is what we would call an ecosystem disruptor. It breaks food web structure by not allowing the energy or in those cells or the carbon in those cells to be passed on to other organisms. So here, those pictures were near Santa Barbara. And again, somebody sent them to me and then 2 days later asked, is that toxic? And my answer back was, you probably should have thought of that 2 days ago when your kids were about waist deep in that stuff. Luckily, it's not, at least not to our knowledge. Here's another bit of it in Huntington Beach. And if you, again, Google Australia and seafoam, you get these kinds of pictures, which is just amazing. I mean, the tremendous amount of foam, it's almost certainly by this Phaeacystis. And to me, it begs the question, what is with Australia? So from those, from rather noxious organisms or disruptive organisms to things that are truly toxic, and we have really three players, that is three toxin players in our area. One which we've only recently become aware of and two that we were well aware of. These are the genera, the organisms that produce it, and I won't go into those too much, but you'll see some pictures of them. The first one is okadaic acid. And this causes the lovely condition of diuretic shellfish poisoning. So it is, you know what the symptoms are. I don't need to go into that. It, even though it is pretty nasty, there are no known fatalities. You may feel like you want to die, but you probably won't actually die. One of the interesting things about this compound, well, a couple things, is that it's produced by organisms that are very distinctive under the microscope. You can't miss these guys. They have these little wing-like structures on them. So they're pretty easy to identify. The other thing that is more frightening about the organisms and this compound okadaic acid that they produce is that it is a strong tumor promoter. It is one of these compounds that it gets in and it affects the cell division cycle. And so it has the potential for causing cancer-like growth. We really don't know too much about this in our local waters, but we do know it's present. We've actually measured it as present. And we are trying now to really follow this organism in more detail. One of the nastiest ones that we have around here is, again, another group of dinoflagellates. Here is our Alexandrium up here. This is another one. These are different genera of dinoflagellates, but they all produce or can produce this saxitoxin compound here. This causes something called paralytic shellfish poisoning. And as that name implies, it stops nerve function, and I mean dead. It will stop your heart if you get enough of it. It will stop your lungs from breathing if you get enough of it. You go into paralysis, and you die of asphyxiation. It doesn't kill people in our area and in most of the world now where they know about it because it is monitored for very carefully. But it is an important one. The other one that we have a little more familiarity with in Southern California, although we have saxitoxins present, but the one we've really seen raise its ugly head is domoic acid. And this is produced by a different group of algae called diatoms within the genus Pseudonychia. And you can see these little kind of boat-like or canoe-like structures here that have a little glass house around them. Domoic acid is the cause of amnesic shellfish poisoning. And it causes a whole variety of symptoms in humans, including some deaths. It has caused a few deaths in the past. It was first described in the 1980s from Eastern Maritime Canada. And it showed up in our coast, on our coast, in about 2000. At least that's when we knew it was there. My guess is it was there before, but again, you know, increased awareness at least was able to show it then. In addition to nausea, vomiting, a whole variety of cramps that can cause disorientation, short-term memory loss, which is where the amnesic part of shellfish poisoning comes from, and if you get enough of it, you can die from this. And as I said, a few people have died. In Southern California, again, we know about this. We monitor for it. The animals, the marine mammals and the seabirds are the ones who have taken it on the chin for this particular toxin. I won't go through this too much, but this is from the Santa Cruz Sentinel. This was published. This is an excerpt of an article that they published in 1961. And they had a 150-year celebration of the centennial publications in 2006. And they published this bit, which talks about a group of sooty shearwaters who came fresh from a fish dinner out at sea and came into land and started acting completely crazy. They were flying in front of cars. They were knocking into people's windows. They were breaking down TV antennas, if any of you are old enough to know what a TV antenna is. They were doing all kinds of crazy things. This is 1961. This was almost certainly a domoic acid poisoning of those seabirds, but there was no knowledge, no awareness of it at that point, and it went undetected by most of us. So the folklore here is that it did not go undetected by this guy over here, Alfred Hitchcock, who actually was vacationing in the area, had a place in the Santa Cruz Hills, and he asked for that particular copy of the Sentinel. And the folklore is that it was the inspiration for his movie, The Birds, which, again, if you like old-time movies, is about a bunch of birds that go wacky and start attacking people and doing all sorts of crazy things. It's feasible. Good science fiction is always feasible. Just to show you what the effects of this can be. So this is the most complicated figure you'll probably see, so I apologize. But it's actually pretty simple. What you're looking at is from 2006 into 2007, and in 06 and 07, we had big blooms of pseudonychia and domoic acid in the water. And the green that you see here and here is indicative of the plankton itself, just taking the plankton, filtering it down, measuring the domoic acid, the presence of the toxin. The gray that you see up above are strandings of here pinnipeds, mostly sea lions, and birds, mostly pelicans. And what you can see is that there's pretty good agreement between when those big mass mortality events occur and the presence of toxin in the water. Not only that, but we were working with a number of the rescue groups at the time, and the red and hatching are animals that were actually tested and tested positive for domoic acid. So there's a pretty good smoking gun here that this is what's taking down some of these animals during these mass mortality events. Okay, switching gears or getting rid of the salt. Freshwater environments. Okay, what about HABs in freshwater communities in California? Unfortunately, the answer is yes. We have quite a few examples in our local waters. This one, don't ever do that with your dog. This is a few examples of that. Most of the blooms in freshwater, unlike the blooms in marine systems, the toxic blooms in freshwater are typically caused by cyanobacteria. There are some exceptions, and I'll get to one. But most of the time, they are cyanobacterial. There's a real dichotomy there. What are cyanobacteria? Well, I mentioned they're a type of photosynthetic bacteria, basically. Their cellular structure is different than algae. Algae have cellular structures that are similar to ours, except we don't have chlorophyll yet. Maybe Craig Venter will fix that. But in any event, the cyanobacteria are very ancient, a very ancient group, more than 300 billion years old. They were around, you know, when life was around. There are more than 90 described cyanotoxins from these organisms. And if you've heard of any of them, the ones you've probably heard of are either microcystins, anatoxin, or cylindrospermopsin. If you've heard of any of them, you probably will, because they are coming on the watch list. And there are regulatory statutes probably not too far away for these compounds, at least in drinking water. Some of the cyanos can also produce saxitoxin. And I don't know if you can read that, but why are there so many compounds? Well, they've had lots of time to build up their chemical defenses, or their chemical warfare. So it's probably one of the reasons why we're seeing so many different compounds. And we haven't finished with identifying all of the compounds. Why should we worry about these guys? Well, obviously there are health impacts, or at least hazards, mortality to humans, domestic pets, wildlife, drinking water exposure, recreational exposure. People don't think much about this, but if you're in water that has a huge amount of cyanobacteria, toxic cyanobacteria in it, you can inhale some of that aerosol. There's skin exposure. And of course, if you eat anything from an environment like that, there's food exposure. We worry a lot about cyanobacteria because climate change bodes for trouble ahead. I love this little figure over here. This is by Hans Perl, the guy who was wrist deep in that sludge from Lake Taihu. He actually put this little figure together that says, cyanos like it hot, take off on Marilyn Monroe. In fact, they do love warm temperatures. And as climate change progresses, we are going to see more and more of our freshwater bodies get warmer and warmer. And with that, we are probably going to see a dominance of cyanobacteria in many of those environments. The other thing we, of course, are aware of with environmental change, and this is our fault, we are eutrophying. That is, we are adding nutrients to a lot of, in particular, freshwater environments. And that just gives them more fuel, obviously, to grow. And then hydrological modifications. Residence time is a big deal. If you're in a chemical warfare, the best thing, and you're well protected, the best thing that can happen for you is that time plays out. You get to outcompete or kill off everybody who is your problem. What we do with large rivers is, in the past, we have dammed them. It's great for power, it's great for water, but what it does is it increases the residence time of the water in the river. So you, in essence, turn it from a river almost into a lake, and you're allowing that competition to play out. And so we have a lot of problems that are mostly the result of the fact that we have held the water in place for too long. We do have some hot spots in California, real hot spots. The pictures that I showed you of Pinto Lake were huge amounts of toxin present. Klamath River is a perfect example of where a dam might be a good idea from some points of view, but not from a harmful algal bloom point of view. And then a few others, Clear Lake and a few of these. That's not really much more than the tip of the iceberg. A very recent study here, it's published last year, has shown that if you look at the wadable streams in California, the yellow is indicative of potentially toxic taxa at the genus level in those locations. The red diamonds are potentially toxic species, so they're real known toxin producers. And then the triangles are no toxins or no toxic substances found. But something like 90% of the stream kilometers, that's the length of the stream, support toxic genera, and about a quarter of them support toxic species. This is something to be concerned about, and the state is concerned about it. Okay, beyond cyanobacteria in freshwater, there are a few other nasty customers that are algae, and this is one of them, an organism called Promnesium parvum, or what it's called in most of the southwestern states now, the golden alga. There's nothing gold about it other than the color of the blooms that it forms. It's a very nasty and a very unique organism. It's not very big. The whole thing is less than 10 micrometers in size, so it's maybe 10 times the size of a bacterium. It's pretty small, but it has a really unique little trick that it can do. Not only is it photosynthetic, and it can make organic material like a plant, but it actually also produces toxins, kills prey, and then makes use of that biomass to make its own self. So it forms blooms of organisms, of itself, by killing all of the other organisms around it. And it's very voracious. It can kill almost everything, and incorporating their material into their own and making more of themselves. As a byproduct, as it were, probably a byproduct, is the effect that the organism has on its competitors and its prey. It also has an effect on the gills of fish. This organism actually produces a toxin that, in essence, pokes a hole in the membrane of a cell, of a predator. It will also poke a hole in the membrane or the cell membrane of gill tissue. So if there are enough of them in the water, as you can see here, you can get these mass fish kills. Well, this organism is something that we have known about for 15 years from the southwestern U.S. So it's occurred in Texas. It's a big deal in Texas. It's had many fish kills that have gone back to the mid-80s. But also Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona. It almost looks like it's been moving west towards us. But we haven't had fish kills that had been attributed to it yet. Maybe a lack of awareness, but maybe just not the organism hasn't been here yet. However, people have done surveys of whether or not it's in the water. And this map of the US shows you that it occurs in a lot of states. It doesn't necessarily cause any fish kills or blooms there, but it's present. So what this sort of suggests is that it's not a new species to the US. It's basically been living in the background. And there might be something that has changed that allows dominance of the organism in some places now. So the idea is that it's probably not an invasive species. It's not sweeping across. But something about the environment is changing that is having this organism now grow up from practically nothing. We've had some recent near misses for California. So out here near Las Vegas, down here in Arizona in 2010 to 2012. But you know, we haven't had any real fish kills, although we do know that it has been present at least since 2006. There's a publication that documented it from the Salton Sea. So it's been here. Salton Sea has a whole bunch of problems. Paramecium is probably only a minor one. But we haven't seen any fish kills until fairly recently. Okay, so here, April 2014, August 2014, September, October 2014, October, November 2014. Four in a very small geographic area in the same year. And they were massive fish kills. Virtually everything in the lake got killed. These have all been private, small private lakes. They're relatively young. Most of them are shallow. They're like less than 5 meters-ish. They're man-made or they're highly modified and they're heavily managed. Okay, these are beautiful lakes or ponds that have been put in for people's admiration, recreation, and all of a sudden we're getting fish kills in these locations. So, one burning question that we've had about this organism is this thing now emerging in California lakes as a consequence of its invasion, which I've already suggested that it probably isn't, or if it's been here, might it actually imply that there are environmental changes that have affected each of these lakes sort of simultaneously that allowed it to bloom? Well, what could be going on? Okay, you have to have been living under a rock to not know something about this. This is a record of precipitation from 1900 all the way to near present. And you can see that the little circle or oval here encircles a bunch of negative values. This is inches of precipitation, and we haven't had any. We've had very little. We've had an extreme drought. Actually, I am incorrect. Because if you look up over here, we have gone beyond, way beyond drought, way beyond severe drought, beyond extreme drought, and we are now in what is called exceptional drought. I don't know what they're going to call it next. I think they're out of adjectives. But here in Southern Cal, you can see we are in this exceptional drought situation. As a consequence, the local lakes have experienced reduced precipitation, of course, but increased evaporative losses. Now, is that important? Yes. These little lakes can lose up to a third of their water each year to evaporation. They don't really have anything coming in. They don't really have anything going out. They just sit there and they bake. And they lose up to a third of their volume. And they do lose a little to seepage, but most of it is evaporation. So they supplement. They pump in water, either from a well or they pump it from the county. But the water coming in isn't completely 100% pure water. It's got dissolved salts in it, some level. And if you keep evaporating the water is going to evaporate, but the salts are going to stay behind. So what happens? If you look at a salinity record, and this is conductivity going from 1970s out towards the present here, and what you can see, conductivity is a direct indication or a very good indicator of the amount of salt present dissolved in the water. And you can see that's basically just a straight line. It's just been going up and up and up and up and up. Does that matter? Well, again, there's a very recent paper that suggests maybe it does. And again, this is a fairly complicated figure, but what you're looking at is it's kind of an idealized view of what somebody thinks makes this golden alga toxic or not, or bloom or not. And what they are showing here is they're showing if you look across a gradient of salt with low salt environments to high salt environments, you actually find that this Pernicium, this golden alga, it doesn't get very stressed at really low salinity. It has no real ability to produce toxins because it in itself is too stressed. Excuse me, not stressed. It's too stressed to be actually be able to produce toxins. Won't grow very well. If you give it a little bit of salt, it seems to like that. It can actually bloom and it can produce toxins at intermediate ranges of salt. But then if you get to too high a salt content, think marine environment or something near that, then you don't have enough stress. The organism isn't stressed enough that it actually wants to kill and eat things and grow. So you have basically areas where there's little or no growth, there's very little toxicity present, but right here, this sweet spot that's got the red circle around it is what we think this organism really likes. Now, if you remember back to that conductivity, that salt figure that I just showed you from one of the local lakes, we think SoCal lakes are doing this. They're moving into this area away from truly freshwater environments into a little bit of brackish water in there. And this is happening as a consequence of continued evaporation, and you keep putting water with a little bit of salt, and eventually that salt concentration increases. If this is going on, this is a nice testable hypothesis, and we're trying to look into this now. So if we are reaching a tipping point, okay, then the management strategies need to be changed. They need to be aimed at reversing those conditions. Right now, what happens in most of these lakes is if the alga comes up, they kill it, and they use things that are not terribly nice to kill it. That's okay, but it's very short-sighted, and it's going to be a very short-term situation if this organism is in its sweet spot for the amount of salt that it has for growth. I'd suggest that some of these small lakes, in particular the ones that are small and are privately owned, they may be tractable in terms of different types of management strategies that give us better outcomes, longer-term outcomes, and don't rely on toxic materials to get to the end point. So what is California doing about harmful algae? I hope I didn't paint this as too blue or too doomsday, because water is a renewable resource. This is something that we can fix, but we do have a number of issues that have really just come on within the last decade or two have come on the table and need to be dealt with. There are some things that are going on at the state level and other places at the federal level, finally. Toledo actually had a silver lining in that it made the feds really stand up and take notice. And so EPA finally came out with some recommended thresholds for some of these toxins in drinking water. And that's probably enough, because just the idea that there are recommended thresholds means that most groups that are going to produce and sell water are going to be very careful about doing that, lest they get sued, even if they're not hard regulations that they are held their feet to the fire. So California's cyanobacteria harmful algal bloom network, there is a what we call CCHABS, which is a working group of California water quality monitoring. What we're trying to do now is to muster the state to start to look at all these different environments, get boots on the ground, see where the problems are, see how bad the problems are. There are health advisories. The California Department of Public Health does wonderful things with a very tiny budget. They monitor mostly in marine systems, but I think we'll see some of that come on their docket for freshwater systems. There's a statewide freshwater HABS strategy that's beginning to be developed. It includes long-term vision, strategy for mitigation, if that's possible. And then there's something lovingly called SWAMP, which is the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. And I'm sure there are going to be more of these groups. I may have missed some already, where we are trying to take the bull by the horns here and get ahead of this problem. Our science challenges have mostly to do with why, when, and where are the toxins produced. We want to know the conditions that lead to toxic blooms, the ecological roles that the toxins play. If we knew a little bit about why they're being produced, we would understand more about how to deal with them, perhaps. And what are the temporal and spatial distributions? It's a daunting problem when you think of the thousands of lakes we have within the state. But there is really good technology now for sensing, for having presence when people are not actually there. And we're trying to adopt that as well. The big questions, can we mitigate the effects of these blooms? Possibly. in some cases, but the fixes have costs. You can kill these things. You can toxify the water, but that doesn't get you too far in the long run. Can we prevent the blooms? That's really what we want to know. It's on the horizon for a few of these. The more scientific understanding we have for what these organisms are, what they're doing, why they're producing toxins, the better understanding we will have for maybe going back and preventing those conditions from developing in the first place. And as I said, there is a bright side. Water is a renewable resource, so this is something that we can do things about. In the meantime, don't do this. Oh, my God. Don't do this. Certainly don't do that. Oh, my God, don't do that. And I wouldn't even do that. You know, I trust that phone, but not that much. And don't do that. We do lose dogs every year in California, unfortunately, to these things. And that's it. I'll be happy to take questions.